It's time for what Podcast International called the greatest podcast in history. Open your ears, because it's time for Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.
Specific thing. By the way, everybody, you're listening to just a sort of an offbeat conversation with Brian Callen and Psycho Mike Catherwood. He's my guest tonight. He's from today. He's from K-Rock and Loveline's, the Loveline show with Dr. Drew. And before we get started on talking to Psycho Mike and more about his tattoos and things, you guys are should follow us on Twitter at ManThoughtsBC, right, Mike? My producer, Mike Casantini's nodding. And I am running a contest to see who can come up with a Man Thoughts t-shirt. I need one so I can sell it and wear it, all right? I'm working on a logo. I don't know what my logo should be. Just come up with a Man Thoughts t-shirt. Send it to me. I'll pay you $1,000. Yeah, Mike, it's not $500 anymore. It's $1,000. $1,000 if you come up with the right t-shirt and I wear it. Okay, let's get back to you, Mike.
I've got my idea.
What is
for
it?
For the t-shirt.
What is it?
You get something that's patently manly, like a gunslinger from the Wild West or like a 1920 strongman.
Yeah.
And he's doing whatever, let's say lifting that kettlebell or something.
Yeah.
And he's got the big bushy handlebar mustache.
Yeah.
And then he's got a thought bubble.
Yeah.
And in the thought bubble, it says, Man Thoughts.
That's actually not bad. That's actually not bad. I'm going to give you $1,000. Mike, you just won $1,000 for doing this podcast.
Give it to an aspiring artist, whoever can make that actually come true, because it's just idle thoughts in my head.
I like it, though. It's actually not bad. It's actually not bad at all. So you got Lemmy's tattoo on your arm.
Yes, yes, his autograph.
I mean, tattoo. Yeah, his autograph on your arm. And you, that's a very specific musical time. Do you play music?
I used to. That's what I wanted to do with my.
Oh,
when
really?
I was 19, I thought for sure, very, very naively. Like, I wasn't. It's so weird because I'm so insecure about a lot of the endeavors I have in the entertainment industry now. But when I was 19, there was no doubt in my mind I was going to be like the next Dave Grohl. Like,
is that right?
It was going to happen. I was going to be a massive rock star.
Were you going to be a lead singer? Did you sing?
Yeah, but I was at the time playing bass and singing in a hardcore band, GFP, Glutton for Punishment. And like, we were not big, but we had some popularity in like the underground hardcore scene. And
right.
This is the late 90s.
And because, by the way, I came up with the Cro-Mags. I don't know if you remember the Cro-Mags.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, John Joseph and Harley, those guys were my buddies back in the day. That's my generation. I actually stood on the stage and kicked people off one time at Lemoore's in Brooklyn while they played. It was pretty cool.
That's pretty manly.
Yeah, I was very manly.
When you're security for the Cro-Mags, like, that's
yeah, all 100, yeah, all 160 pounds of me at the time. You know,
it doesn't
please.
Matter.
Yeah, at
it
least I was
matter.
Kicking.
Yeah.
Think
about when you say it's all 160 pounds of me. Analyze any kind of post-apocalyptic book or movie. It's never the big swole guy makes it through.
Because you need less food.
Yeah.
You need less food. They said that about the Viet Cong. They said the Viet Cong, probably the average American GIs, they were about 6'2" and just bigger and needed a lot of food. And, you know, Viet Cong guys lived on a handful of rice.
Human beings are the only species that doesn't subscribe to the idea as survival is what is measure strength. Like all other animals, we look at what makes them good, what makes them tough.
Yeah,
it's their ability to survive stuff.
Yeah,
humans, we just, it's like who's bigger and handsomer.
Dude,
but it doesn't really
there's a guy, I can't remember his name, and he was some big guru for people, like corporate people. He would, like, he'd restructure their lives, and you know, he had to spend a lot of money on it. He was like a Tony Robbins guy. He was from England. And he was dating a girl that I knew. And I said to him, I go, what about me, man? You've hung out with me a couple of times. What's my problem? What would be, you say, my psychological hang up? And he goes, well, he said, I think you're very well put together and you're very honest. He said, but I think you have only one sense of what strength is. And I said, what's that? He goes, well, you think that strength is, you know, the guy who can lift the most in the gym and run through a wall. And you're not that guy. You have a different kind of strength. And at the time, I was doing a lot of jiu-jitsu, you know. And he was a big guy, rugby player. And I said, well, explain it. He said, well, I'm much bigger than you. You think I could lift more than you could? And I said, yeah, you look like a tank. Yeah. And he said, but how would you do in a fight against me? And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, you're a big guy. I mean, have you ever fought? And he said, no, I played rugby. I go, but you've never fought? He said, no. I said, I think I'd keep you busy. I mean, yeah. You know, I don't want to say anything, but if you never fought, I'm going to keep you busy, right? And he said, what would you do? And I said, probably get behind you and choke you out. You know, at the time I was working on my arm drags a lot and just getting behind guys. But whatever. But he said, the point is that you look at strength as a dog and you're a cat. And a dog can kill a cat if a dog can catch a cat. But my guess is you'd be up on a wall somewhere watching and not in. You're very good at avoiding. There's different kinds of strength is what he was trying to say. Yeah. It was kind of a life-changing experience for me. I was like, fuck, I'm a cat. I'm not a dog. Meow.
And it's true. Like, strength, it's so strange how people have such a narrow view of it. But, I mean, I was talking to Dr. Drew, who I host the radio show with, and he was saying that really why people value being a doctor, a real doctor, so much is not necessarily just because of the intellectual capacity to do it, because most people have what it takes IQ-wise to be a doctor.
Sure.
It's that very few people have what it takes to make it through medical school and make it through residency. Hmm. It takes a certain strength, a certain grit to go 3 or 4 days without sleeping and then have to show up at it and listen to a doctor yell at you and have bedside manner and do it. And for year after year after year, it's like a one percenter type thing of the guys and gals who really have the strength and the balls to pull that off.
And I think also what's interesting about that is that when you're a doctor as well, like sometimes you got to go out and tell parents that their kid isn't going to make it or that they're going to die. You know, you've got cancer and you're going to die. And that's a different kind of heroic. That takes a different kind of self-control and strength. And you know, I was talking to Howard Wasdin, who is wrote a book called SEAL Team 6. And he after being this decorated SEAL Team 6 commando who got his leg blown to bits in Somalia and took out a whole bunch of people, he then went on, he was lost for a long time, and he defined himself so long as being the baddest guy on the planet, and then he went on and said, I'm going to be a chiropractic biophysicist, which is, you know, a chiropractor but like basically with doctor training, and I'm going to go heal people, which is a different kind of strength, which is a different kind of heroics, which is a very different way of defining yourself, but it's still just as manly in a lot of ways. Because when you're fucking, when you can't move your neck, you're not looking for the Navy SEAL commando who's good with a knife. You're looking for the fucking guy who's good with his fingers and who can gently bring you back to health.
It sounds a little overdone, but that can be life-saving. If you're in chronic pain and someone can put you out of it,
That is everything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm fucking dealing with my neck right now, so I've been thinking about that a lot.
The jiu-jitsu will do that.
Fuck. Or just live it. Or volleyball on the beach, not warming up. That's really how I got it. It's so unmanly.
Or a couple nights at the bathhouse, breaking off hummers.
Those fucking guys were so strong. They were Turkish, and their mustaches were so thick. I'm okay. Edit that out. Don't put it on my fucking man. Oh, fuck it. It's all about honesty.
I've never blown a man, and...
I wish you'd just been like, I've never blown a man. That's when you know somebody's blown somebody.
Yeah.
I've never blown a guy. What? Dude, there's nothing that comes
after
that?
The weighted pause is huge. I've never blown a man, and I'm shocked by that because of the time at how much I loved blow. I loved cocaine so much. I loved to smoke cocaine so much.
No shit. Did you do a lot of drugs?
Yeah. I've been sober. It'd be 10 years, the 23rd of this month of October.
Wow.
I know.
What do you think it was about blow that got you? I mean,
I don't know.
You keep yourself in great shape, obviously.
I'm definitely like into taking care of myself, but there was a passion for stimulants in particular, meth and cocaine that like,
wow, meth.
And I think it's the polar opposite of the person who gets into opiate based stuff like the heroin and painkillers.
One's a stimulant.
Because I tried it and I gave it a shot and I just wasn't someone who's all that pumped on eating Vicodin or smoking heroin.
No, you like to feel up.
And I don't know what it was, but I loved it. And it really was the first thing that made me feel comfortable for the first time in my life.
Where do you think the insecurity comes from? I mean, you're a good-looking guy. You're in shape. You know, successful guy. What do you think? What do you think it was about your childhood?
I think. I mean, I had my parents certainly loved me, and I with Loveline in particular, listened to kids who had a lot of abuse, real abuse, and so I would never try to put myself in that category. But my father, a very high achiever, and very high function. He was a business consultant for a multi-purpose business firm, and a former military guy. And he worked for military intelligence, highest clearance military intelligence during the a cool era, you know, in the late 60s through the early 80s.
Jesus.
And we're living in the Pentagon and, you know, looking at these huge radars and stuff. Then he went into the business world and he was working, you know, traveling all over the country, all over the world, really, being a consultant, showing big companies how to make their business better. And my mother, you know, she came from abject poverty. She was the product of Mexican immigrants to Los Angeles and stuff. And there was like real poverty, not knowing how they were going to eat for the day with Jeez. Six sisters in East Los Angeles.
Jeez.
So I just don't think she really understood what it meant to be like a loving mother. And I'm doing the air quotes.
Yeah.
You know, but I always knew my parents loved me, and I had a kind of somewhat normal upbringing. But I was left to fend for myself for the most part.
You grew up in L.A.?
Yeah, right, in like over by Dodger Stadium area, East Side, and Pasadena area. And I was one of those kids that like I came home from school or football practice, whatever it was, and like if I didn't have any visible blood or marks, it was like, okay, cool, go to your room, we'll talk to you, and we, you know.
Yeah,
and then I
so you were a little bit invisible.
Yeah, and I
that's
think
that's a huge part of that, addiction. You know, a lot of people were just never looked at.
I think that developed that feeling of you know, when you really like I was talking about with your producer before the show, you analyze what the factors are to someone limiting themselves. You know, feeling unlovable, feeling afraid, feeling worthless. And for me, it was just I never really felt like I was worthy of any type of success or love, and that was. It's. Yeah, I mean, I still
deal
with it.
Somebody talked to me about what do you do this podcast for, and I was like, well, you know, I'm at an age where, I'm a lot of young men are looking at me, you know, when I go to do my stand up or something, and they're like, what do you read? And what it just comes with the territory when you've had some success, you're older and stuff. I remember being lost as shit when I was in my teens and early 20s. I didn't know where to place my energy. And so I was talking to my buddy Daniel over here who books all you guys, and you know, I said I do it because it's about inspiration. I just want to be. I want to provide and just maybe some guidance because I've made so many more mistakes than most people just because I'm older. So maybe I can kind of help people by talking to people like you who've been through this shit. It's you know, I'm a comedian, but I can never really be that funny on this podcast because it's always more about just kind of trying to figure out a way to. Because life is kind of serious for some people, man. Life is a little bit unbearable for a lot of people.
And I think we underestimate how many people life is serious for. I mean, when we go, well, life is serious for, it's for the kid who lives on the streets or the parents who have parents who are drug addicts or what. No, I mean, life can be serious for the lion's share of most of us, certainly young guys.
That's why
you know?
I can't stand when I'm in Hollywood and some actors running around like, you know, like what they have to say and what they have to think and what they feel is everything and really important. Get a little perspective, motherfucker. There are people that are suffering all the time. That's all I ask from people. Have respect for other people suffering because you got it fucking good.
Yeah.
I was thinking about myself. Somebody asked me the other day, how you doing? I was like, how am I doing? I won the lottery historically, okay? I'm a white guy in America getting paid for what he loves to do. And I'm fucking good looking.
You are.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's been the elephant in the room. My jawline, my shoulders that seem to float over my tapered waist.
Do you ever, because it's so, I mean, the shoulders are so broad in comparison to the tapered, beautiful waist. Mm. Do you ever think you want to dial it back a little just to make people feel comfortable?
I try. Honestly, if there's a stiff wind sometimes, I actually start to fly. I got that going. I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say that out loud. It's just how it is when you're built like a fucking fan.
It's weird when you talk about like guys being lost, especially in 2012. A man on theartofmanliness.com, a great website, and I wish I could remember who it was. But
remember
he wrote
that website. I got to go to that.
Artofmanliness.com. He wrote a great article about the problem with the modern man. And I think he analyzed something and pinpointed something that's very true in that when my father graduated high school and generations before us in modern history, you really didn't have many options. You could go into the military, you could go to college, or you could go to work immediately and try to make a life for yourself, get a family, go to suburbia, start making kids. Boom. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Now and don't get me wrong, personal freedom's great. But I think because really the world is your oyster, you know, for an 18, 19-year-old male now, it's like, hey, maybe I'll try the entertainment industry. Maybe I'll start my own website. Maybe I'll travel the world and see what that brings me. Who knows? Because there is so much freedom, it's almost like flying through space. It's liberating at first, but there's no point of reference.
Studies about the more choices you have in a lot of ways, the less happy you become.
Yeah.
And in fact, a lot of times there was a guy who was just on NPR, and there's a great talk on TED.com. I think he talks about the science of happiness, which is when people have a devastating loss, 3 months later, they almost always come back to their default point of where they were happy. I mean, the human beings are very good at creating synthetic happiness.
Yeah.
And when they have no choice and they have to make one life-changing choice, no matter what that choice is, they will find a way to create happiness around that choice. And you're right. It's when you have so many different choices, so many different options, it's really hard because, you know, Thomas Jefferson said the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. The idea is, you know, being that you may have freedom of choice, but it just means you're your own boss,
yeah, man,
and that takes a lot of fucking work.
And it's scary when you realize that. I think when you're not your own boss for the first time, it really scares the shit out of you.
Dude, I was in Los Angeles at 28 on a TV show with a lot of money and no responsibility. I had 50,000 girlfriends.
Yeah.
I don't know. The fact that I never got herpes is proof that God loves me more than everybody else.
Yeah.
Okay? Because I never wore a condom. Now,
that's ridiculous.
I can't believe I said that out loud again. But, you know, I mean, the bottom line is, you know, you're right. You part of what I think is good for a career is getting married for a guy sometimes, yeah, and having kids because you got to be home.
Trent Reznor was on Kevin and Bean back when I was still a part of that show, and he said something that always stuck with me. He said when he was having trouble with creativity, when he couldn't write, he just didn't think like ideas were coming to him, he would restrict his options. He would write a song with only one string on the guitar. He would write a song using only one note.
Huh.
And he would force himself to really, really pare it down to absolute minimalism. And from that, every single time grew
that's
more
so
creativity.
Fucking cool, because right now I'm trying to work on a whole new hour. And I've just devoted myself to doing, I'm going to do everything that's just as organic to me as possible. And I'm getting rid of a lot of stuff that really works on stage. Like I've got a bit on Sharks that just crushes, but ultimately it's not really me. It's just fluff, and it's just, yeah, putting English on a ball when you know, it's like that pool expression. And it's interesting because once you start restricting yourself, it really does force your imagination to kind of like explode. But why did you stop doing music? Was it drugs?
Yes and no. I mean, I moved back to Los Angeles when I got clean, and that's when I subsequently, right at that same time, had quit being in this band. You know, the lead singer passed away from drug overdose, and
wow,
and my life was like in total disarray. So I started listening to my parents for the first time. I'm 19, and they said, "Why don't you at least give normal person life a shot?" So I moved to the East Coast.
I love parents.
And my family now is in the farming and in agriculture. My dad has a vineyard in Central California.
Wow.
And
where?
Paso Robles, California. Dude, San Luis Obispo
that's
County.
That's great.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's not so great if you're a sober guy, but it's,
yeah,
it's still
right,
a beautiful
you
art.
You can't drink wine. Shit, I love wine.
And it's really a beautiful process to see. But either way, so I'm like, well, maybe I'll learn how to take over the family business. So it was like I could go to UC Davis, or I could move to the East Coast and go to Rutgers, which is like the farming school of the East Coast, you know? And so I did. I moved to the East Coast. I picked up and left. I got off the plane in New Jersey, and I was smoking crack in like 8 days. And that's
shit,
not exactly. I was already
just,
found,
wow,
like that network of people, and I was showing people how to make better rocks and stuff. And I was like, and that I never went to class. I started smoking.
You know what's
rocks.
Funny about you is at least I can tell, like, at least you excel at everything you do, including drugs. Like,
you know what? It's funny. Thank you. That's a very nice comment, but I'm not that guy. I'm really not.
You just seem like you're a very smart guy. Obviously it's funny. I'm talking to him and you got a name like Psycho Mike, and I can always pick up on things. It's very interesting. You keep yourself in great shape, but you're a very thoughtful guy. I can feel it from
Thank you.
I can see it right away.
That's,
you know,
that might be true. Whether or not those thoughts have any value, I don't know, but I'm an introspective guy. I spend, and I don't know if enough people in the modern day do that, you know, with like instant gratification stuff. But I spend a good chunk of my day just thinking about
stuff. Do you have a primary thought, do you think? Do you have a primary thought? Do you have a primary question that runs through your head every day?
I do. I think to me it's really pinpointing what the value of a human being is. And, you know, with so many people we see, certainly in our industry, that are very successful and get a lot of people to applaud them and give them accolade, does that make them truly any better or worse than someone who has no motivation or doesn't achieve anything? And should the top of the food chain be the person who devotes their life to doing what is moral? You know, people like Mother Teresa or Mandela or whatever, someone who devotes their life to a cause, to making humanity as a whole better, is that person intrinsically better?
I would say that the answer to that question is that human beings all have a potential, a particular potential.
Yeah.
I think we all play a role in the grand scheme of this game. Well, you know, I'm sure there is a role in the grand scheme of things for a hitman in one way or another. Otherwise, we wouldn't have movies to write about these nefarious characters. But I always say to young people, find out, listen carefully to that little voice. There is a voice. Just listen to it. Get the distractions out of the way. If you're smoking weed all day and listening to music too much, you're not going to hear that voice. Just for a second, sit still and listen. That's one of the values of sobriety. Listen to that voice, because there is a voice inside you that's going to tell you what you want to do. It may be an outrageous thing. It may be to go join the SEALs or be a rock star or be a senator. I don't give a fuck what it is. But if you really listen to what you want to do and you're honest about the motivation, you know,
right,
it'll lead you to that direction. It's very important to learn where to place your energy. And so a human being's intrinsic value for me is someone who comes closest to realizing that potential, using all their talents along the lines of excellence, as Aristotle would say. That's the idea. So, you know, the tragedy and the sin in the human condition is those people that had a talent and had potential and didn't realize it.
Yeah.
That's where I think people like Mother Teresa or Nelson Mandela or Stephen Jobs or whoever, whatever visionary there is out there, their value is not so much what they accomplished, but rather their example. And their example often is that of someone who reaches, not necessarily touches and gets to, but is reaching, always reaching. I've always had such a love for fighters, for professional fighters, like my buddy Nate Marquardt, you know, or I recently hung out with Shane Carwin and my buddy Brendan Schaub. And these guys are pro fighters. And what I love about them so much, what I love about fighters is that it's such an austere and difficult life. They may never wear the belt, although my boy Nate is a Strikeforce champion. I'm so proud of him. But it never ends. There are people headhunting you all the time. You're always reaching. You're always using everything you have, your courage, your talent, your mind, your skill, your muscle, to try to get to that point. It's all going to be taken away from you.
It's the most clear analogy for life as a whole. Fighting is the most clear analogy for life.
Yes,
it's true.
I think so. People say, well, she's a fighter. Well, my buddy Nate Marquardt's a fighter.
Right.
Nate goes, you know, I'm always ready to die in the ring. We did this great podcast where he's just like, I'm always ready to die in the ring because I have to be. Because that guy is.
Just like addicts, I think fighters, whether they actually end up fighting or not, fighters have a certain thing about them, a certain unique quality that you just can't teach or learn. It is either in you or not. Like, and certain people that, like, certain soldiers you talk to that, you know, are war heroes, people who survive diseases. My girlfriend's brother has no legs. He got a terrible accident, a train accident in Prague. Has Jesus. No legs. The guy's an Iron Man. Like, literally, he goes to Kona. He's on this weekend. He's going to be in Kona. He's going to do an extreme triathlon.
People like that make me. And it's like, dude, you don't have any legs. You're not allowed to do Ironman. Yes, yeah. I am, and I'll do the one in Hawaii.
And I think there's a certain quality to that where, even though he never stepped in a ring, he's never been in a fight in his life. He's a very mild mannered guy. There's a fighter's quality that not a lot of people have.
Absolutely. I mean, come on. That is the cool thing about life, is you're right. You can push yourself to your limit doing anything. You can push yourself to the limit being a thinker. I think writers.
Yeah.
I think great writers are fighters. I mean, I'm sorry. Writing a great book the way Jonathan Franzen does, or, you know, God, I'm trying to think of the book I'm reading right now. You can see what an impact it's had on me. But I just finished reading Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, which is a classic about censorship. It was just a send-up on censorship. This guy, when you look at an empty page and at the end of 5 years, 10 years, like Junot Diaz, he wrote the book, The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, W-A-O, which won a Pulitzer Prize. 10 years to write that book. You want to talk about an act of faith. And he starts with an empty page and comes up with a masterpiece like that.
Right.
That changes the way I think, the way I look at the world, and the way I feel. And more importantly, forces me to reassess and ask who I am and what I'm doing here. That's the value. That's heroic.
The writer, or even the comic, it's the same way. You know, not to blow smoke, these are the modern day Mark Twains, because those are the people who take an idea or a thought, and they either mold it or manipulate it in a way that makes the most sense to people. And if you can inspire thought with your thoughts, that's it. That's it to me. I mean, that's the supreme.
That's it.
That's the home run for like human potential. Yeah.
That's what somebody said about the United States. The United States has to always remember that we are an idea, a beautiful and powerful idea called the Constitution, called freedom, equality, and freedom for all. That's the ideal. I'm not saying we reach it, but the U.S. has always got to be seen as someone that is trying and reaching. It's one of the reasons I voted for Obama. I voted for Obama not because I necessarily agree with a lot of his politics, because I'm a libertarian, but I voted for Obama because I liked the idea of showing the world that we as America will vote somebody who's black into office, half black, whatever you want to call it. But I love that idea. I think we really showed the world something. We showed the world that not only did we elect a guy named Barack Obama, we elected a guy named Barack Hussein Obama. He's got a Muslim name, and think about how close Obama and Osama are. Our arch enemy. Think about Saddam Hussein and the fact that his middle name is Hussein, and Americans looked right past that, which is fantastic, and said, I'm going to vote for this guy. That is a classic example of the fairness of the American character. There is something called the American character, as eclectic as we are as a group, and that is the idea that we are all potential. We all can achieve something great if we put our minds to it.
Right, and identifying, like you were saying earlier, identifying that potential and being able to commit yourself to it and develop it to the fullest. That really is something. And I, you know, it's funny because everybody in my industry likes to trash a guy like Ryan Seacrest just because, you know, he's kind of a cheese ball. But at the same time, I admire Ryan Seacrest to the fullest. Because
I worked for them. Yeah, he's a pretty impressive guy.
At age 7, he decided, I want to be the next Casey Kasem, and devoted his effing life to doing it.
Did he?
Took every step to do so, and became this really dependable, very admirable broadcaster that, yes, is he going to do something threatening? Is he going to do something unique or special? Probably not. But is he reliable and
he's
bankable
also, he's
as
also
a guy?
Doing what he wanted.
Right.
I worked with him on a show. He was my boss, basically, produced a show called Bank of Hollywood. Terrible show, but I was the host. So I spent a week with him, you know, and talking and stuff. He was great. He was just a great guy. But I said, how you doing, man? He goes, I'm having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And he's also making $13, $14 million a year. Guy couldn't be more busy. You know, I don't really like what he puts out, frankly. I mean, the Kardashians thing. But at the same time, you're right. I mean, he knew what he wanted to do, and that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
And he, by the way, you're right. He's very good at what he does. You need Ryan Seacrest.
Sure. You know? Just like you need Jay-Z. If Jay-Z can't exist without like Will Smith raps. And Slayer can't exist without Third Eye Blind. I mean, you have to have that to be able to.
Who's your favorite band of all time?
Favorite band of all time would be probably either Black Flag or maybe Talking Heads. Talking Heads is
they are great. That's a very interesting call. Black Flag, Henry Rollins. I remember that's my generation. I remember when he came out, I was in high school, and all the girls thought he was so handsome.
Yeah,
he was just like this thick neck. I've seen him on auditions periodically.
He's an interesting
thickest
dude.
Neck. I'm like, dude, would you relax?
Yeah.
My buddy goes, love your poetry. He goes, spoken word. All right, Henry, you win.
Yes.
But I might punch you in the fucking face.
Yeah.
Thick neck and all.
Thick neck and all. I'm gonna give you a shot.
I might beat you up just for saying that.
You got to get him on this show. He'd be a fascinating.
I'd love to, actually. Yeah. Let's try to get Rollins on. Do you know him?
Not personally. I mean, I know him, but we're not like going out to dinner or anything.
He seems like a very cagey guy. What's he doing nowadays?
He does a show on IFC, you know, Henry Rollins. And then he has, you know, a lot of like, he does his tours of spoken word and stuff like
that. He does.
So he's a frenetic thinker. He's another guy that just spends a lot of time thinking, you know, and really trying to develop his views on stuff. You know?
Yeah.
Which is respectable.
Yeah, it is. The fundamental difference between a guy like that and me is I'm just always looked at life a little bit more humorously. He's a serious. It's like Sean Penn, same thing. I see Sean. He's just such an intense, heavy dude.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, dude, can you just lighten the fuck up? You know. But at the same time, I mean, I'm not Sean Penn. That's why I don't win Oscars.
And you have to respect a guy like Sean Penn's talent. But I think that there is certain. It's certain in a way. It's. And I don't want to insult a guy I don't know at all. I don't know Sean Penn, you know, from Adam. But I think there's a certain pretentiousness that comes along with being that seriousness.
Well, I also
that
think it's
serious
a guilt.
All the time.
I think Sean Penn suffers from, and it's to his credit in a way, for having probably a huge heart. I think he feels very guilty about being born into very privileged circumstances and having all this stuff go his way. He's a great actor. He works his ass off, and I one of my favorite actors. But I think a man like that who really gives a shit about the world, and he gives a shit about the world.
Yeah.
You can say, I'm not even a fan of his politics. That dude went to fucking Haiti a number of times and really tried to do something.
It seems legitimate.
More, that's more than I've ever done. And I think that a guy like that is somebody who just genuinely feels very guilty and is acutely aware of how lucky he's been and wants to do something about it. He wants to somehow make the world a better place. So that's why I've always loved the guy. As long as he minds his P's and Q's around me, because if he thinks he can knock me out, he wouldn't last fucking 5 seconds. You understand? Look at me walking around like a tough guy.
Turn him off.
I'm such a loser. Dude, you want to hear a
story?
Shut
his brain off and fly away with
those
laughs.
I got to tell a great story. This happened to me, okay? When my girl was pregnant, okay? I'm in a fucking... and Jamie Kaler, if you're listening to this, you're a witness to this. This is a great story about me. I'd been watching this jiu-jitsu move. I think Mario Sperry was showing this awesome, like, where the guy goes under and you grab the chin as opposed to the neck, and then you can choke him out really easily. And I was practicing it on different my friends. So I'm like, I go to stand up to watch my buddy do stand up for the first time, and I'm just thinking about that move the whole time. But this is the idiot that I am, right? And I'm not a tough guy. I'm not even a fighter. Let's just, you know, I got friends who are fighters. I'm a fucking comedian and a jackass, but I'm also dramatic. So this guy starts heckling my friend. So I go, shut the fuck up, which I never do. But he was just getting me so angry. He was so disrespectful. He's with these dumb girls. And Jamie Kaler looks at him and goes, why don't you just leave? And the guy goes, why don't I just punch you in the fucking face? I go, that's it. I go, all right. And I come at him.
Yeah.
And the waitress.
This is in the club.
This is in the fucking World Cafe.
Sweet.
If anybody, I'm sure, and I think Carl DiGregorio was there. The waitress sticks her little fingers in my stomach, and I can't get to the guy because she's digging her thing. So my buddy Mike Muldoon grabs me, pulls me away, and now I'm pulled away. And I go, you're a little bitch. You're talking. Let's go outside, bro. And he goes, let's go outside. And he goes out. He goes, I'll be waiting outside quietly. And all of a sudden I go, wait a minute. I might have to fight this guy. And I haven't fought in a long time. Oh, and by the way, and my wife goes, hey, I'm pregnant. You going to go fight him? Because you have to be on stage in Dallas tomorrow. So what's you want to go fight him? You don't know anything about him. So I didn't know you were fighting a lot. Are you a fighter now? Oh, and by the way, you might get sued, or you might get arrested, or you'll get all your teeth knocked out. But either way, you're gonna have to be on stage in Dallas tomorrow. Are you a fighter? Yeah. I'm just wondering. So I literally go, I don't want to fucking fight this guy. I there's no upside to it. If I beat him up, I get sued. If he beats me up, I'm fucking. I lose a tooth, or the cops arrest me. I don't want to spend time in. There's no upside. So right. I immediately go. I go to my buddy Mike Muldoon. I go, Mike, I gotta fucking go out there and pretend to fight this guy. But you can't let me fight him. You have to hold me back, because otherwise I'm gonna look like a total pussy. So I have to go out there and I'm gonna make a lot of noise. But you gotta fucking hold me back. Don't let me fight this guy. He was such a loser. And then I saw him later as we were walking out, and he was shadow boxing in the parking lot. And I'm with my pregnant wife, and I go, maybe I'll just fight this guy now, because he wasn't that big. I mean, he wasn't a tough guy. He was just an idiot. She goes, are you out of your fucking mind? What? No, yeah. I go, yeah, you're right. That's a bad idea. I gotta go. So we get in the car, and I pull up my Prius. I drive a red Prius, okay? Yeah, that's how tough I am.
Tough car.
Yeah, I'm a real tough guy. And he's still shadow boxing with his friend, and I go, hello, I'll miss you. Sorry we couldn't fight. And he just looks at me and goes, motherfucker. And I just roll out in my Prius, like, really slowly. See ya. And I'm waving like that as I drive away. I was so tough.
But the reason came into play.
Of course it did. What the fuck? I might have gotten my ass kicked, you know?
Can we get maybe, in here? Maybe you did. Maybe you would have kicked his ass, but at the same time.
Yeah, and gotten arrested and gotten sued. The funny thing about taking jiu-jitsu and all that stuff is it actually, you better have a good lawyer if you break somebody's arm.
Right.
Because you're going to lose your fucking house.
Yeah, I trained jiu-jitsu as well. And the number one thing that I think I positively take away from it is that when shit gets really hectic, whether it be professionally, in my personal life, you develop a certain composure. When you purposely go in and have guys bigger, stronger, more technically skilled than you are fucking you up, and dude, maybe they've got you.
Absolutely.
Maybe they're in north south and they're making you you cannot breathe.
You know how you make a street fighter, you know, badass street fighter, you know how you scare the shit, you know how you cure a street fighter? Put him in a real fight gym and have them start fighting guys that look like they're built like to deliver UPS packages, and the guy's getting lit up every day, and very quickly he realizes, holy shit, I might find one of these guys in a bar and lose my whole life.
Right.
Because when you get hit in the chin or the stomach or the floating rib or whatever, your whole life changes, and you're kicked in the thigh. Good luck. Or you get tapped out like that. it's so true. If you want to humble yourself, just go to a fight gym. And I always say that. I think sports are important because they teach you how tough you're not.
Right.
I know exactly how tough I'm not, man. Scott Laughlin wrote an article called Never Trust Anybody Who Hasn't Been Punched in the Face. You ever read it?
No, but it makes a lot of sense.
It's great. He just talks about you know, the idea that at the end of the day, you know, in civilization, when you meet a guy, what you really want to know is he going to be there for you in a fight, because everything else goes out the window.
And that again, translates into life perfectly. Bill Clinton said in his book, the best thing that ever happened to him is the first time he ran for Oklahoma governor. Is it Oklahoma? Arkansas governor. First time he ran for Arkansas governor, he got his ass handed to him. I mean, really bad. Like, he got, you know, 13% of the vote.
Right.
And he said it was the best thing that ever happened to him. Yeah. And because he got humble and really reassessed what he was doing and had to go out there. And it's like the best thing that ever happened to certain, you know, champion fighter.
Champion hasn't been knocked
out. There's a time and a place when Anderson Silva was just not a very good fighter. He was in a bad camp. He wasn't performing well. And that might have been the best thing that ever happened.
Well, they say about Anderson, they say he's the perfect student. That's why he's so great. I was talking to Tiago Alves, my buddy, who said, who knows him and trained with him many years. He said he's just a martial arts nerd. The guy loves martial arts so much, he just practices everything.
Even Steven Seagal shows him moves.
By the way, and he's open enough to take that and use the front kick, you know, if that's really what he taught him. But you're right. I mean, the guy trains so hard because he's aware of his own, you know, inadequacies, actually. He trains harder than everybody else.
Right.
That's what they say about Jordan. That's what they say about Kobe Bryant. Kobe Bryant practices more than anybody else.
Yeah. I really good friends with some radio guys here in L.A., Petros and Money Show, Matt Smith and Petros Papadakis. They do, and there was a time and a place when their show was on the official Lakers channel. And Matt got really, really deep access to the Lakers. And he was telling me, he said, like Kobe or hate Kobe, it's legitimate. All the rumors, all the beliefs that he works harder than anybody else, it's the truth.
Dude.
Kobe shows up. He, you know, in his Lamborghini or with his helicopter or whatever, Kobe shows up earlier than the other players.
That's
Kobe's working on his post game earlier than he stays later than the other
That's
guys.
Why he
he's conditioned. He's
points.
Never not conditioned. I mean, it's true. There's a certain kind of weird thing.
Say what you will, and that does take a certain. They always said Jordan was a prick. Like, you hear people say Jordan was not a nice guy. If you beat him at pool, he wouldn't talk to you for 3 days.
Right.
Well, he's also the greatest basketball player to ever play the game. So, you know what? If he's a prick, I'll take it. It's a little bit like saying Martin Luther King cheated on his wife. I get it. Yeah. You know what? I'm going to overlook that shit. I'm going to overlook it.
Yeah.
All right? Because apparently Gandhi was cheating on his wife when his mother died and didn't get the chance to say goodbye to her, and that's why it took a vow of celibacy. So, you know what? I'll fucking overlook that shit.
When you put it on the scales of justice,
yeah,
when
you're like a
other.
Human Jesus, I think I'll overlook it. So
I
let's
agree.
Not get too carried away. But, you know, I'm a lot like Gandhi, and I never cheat on my wife. The point is, in the podcasting world.
You're a lot like Gandhi, but much more muscular and better looking.
Thank you. Yeah. Please, speaking of which, you've got the best hair in the fucking business. We got to get you in front of the camera. I'm
Thank
so
you,
jealous. I'd love to have thick hair. You probably have to have your hair thinned.
I guess.
Every time I do a movie or a TV show, they're like, do you want us to fill it in? Should we fill your hair in? I'm like, my see-through hair? Sure.
Yeah, I have more hair than you do, but you have, as far as the less hair goes, you have the manly, like, Bruce Willis thing.
Yeah.
Like,
the,
it could be much, you know.
It's called being 45, but thank you so much.
No, but I'm saying, like, there's a certain, like, masculine receding hairline, as opposed to, like, you're not Mr. Drummond from fucking Different Strokes.
Yeah, that's
like,
a problem where you're losing,
like the male pattern. They, you know, speaking of Jordan, they say, I remember a 2020 or a 60 Minutes he did in the mid-90s when he was balling it up, that they asked him why he always shaves his head. It's because he was
losing his
pattern balling. Can you imagine if he'd let that go?
God.
If he was dunking on people with, like, Monty Burns hair? That'd be
the
shit.
Well, dude, how about the fact that he wears a Hitler mustache now?
That is insane.
It's like, dude, I know you're doing a Hanes commercial. Can we lose the Hitler mustache? Can you just grow it out a little bit?
I don't like my shirts with bacon neck.
Right.
Like, wait, no, let's stop.
Wait a minute.
Here, one second.
Michael, why are you goose-stepping? This is so awkward. I mean, fucking guy's got a Hitler mustache. I'm like, I know you're black and all, and I'm sure, you know, Hitler would have put you on a train, but still, can you fucking grow the mustache out? It's kind of hostile.
Yeah.
Jesus.
It's a bad...
I mean, he's the only fucking human being on the planet that can get away with wearing a Hitler mustache.
He might be. He's
Nobody's ever going to say, hey, Jordan, I'm going to start calling you Adolf if you don't grow that mustache.
It's an elite club of I can pull off the Hitler mustache.
Nobody else can do that shit. That is just an aggressive facial hair move. I think we've covered pretty much. How much time? Where are we at?
About 10 minutes.
Let's make it count.
We only got 10. What are we at?
You can go as long as you want.
No, this guy, this is fantastic.
Yeah, you go as long as you want.
Thanks. Thanks, man. Thanks, Mike. Mike, we're going to have to get you a microphone. So what else? Do you think of any other t-shirt designs? You're wearing the Mother Mary on your
Yes,
shirt.
I do have the...
It looks good. When you've got sort of Mexican blood, there's something... It's funny how if you're kind of muscular the way you are and you've got Mexican, like, you know, got thick hair and an olive skin, and you've got like a religious sort of the Mother Mary, it actually looks tough.
Yeah.
It makes you look a little bit like a gangster.
Yeah.
It's the only group of people that can actually make the Mother Mary look somewhat gangster.
It's funny.
Hanging from there.
Because I have the Virgin Mary tattoo too on my forearm.
Are you a religious guy?
Yeah, I am.
Do you find religion?
No, I'm not one of those guys who got sober and then became religious. Mm. And I certainly am not someone who would want to impose religion on anybody else. Mm. I would never, I can understand the massive flaws in organized religion. But for me, when I grew up, my dad's Irish, my mom's Mexican. So I was
very
like
Catholic.
As Catholic as they come.
Right.
And as alcoholic as they come. Mm. But I went to, I grew up Catholic and it was a place for me where there was always a lot of peace and serenity, and there was a lot of thought going on. You know, say what you will about organized religion, a lot of biblical scholars are incredibly smart people.
Absolutely.
And
yeah, talk to a priest sometime about philosophy alone.
Right. And I came to a point where I recognized that the Bible is a socially constructed book. It's a fable, just like and it probably isn't written by some deity. And it's just this,
but it's got deep wisdom,
like Gilgamesh or Oedipus Rex. It's just a great fable, and I
can't believe this motherfucker is dropping Gilgamesh and Oedipus Rex. This is a well read guy. I love that. It's, you know how rare that is in LA to even have somebody make that statement.
I guess there was a lot of downtime for me, and I was never.
Did you ever read The Power of Myth by Joseph Campbell?
I did, but I don't.
Well, this is what he talks about: the power of these books, the power of these seminal books, these books that create motifs and scaffolding for our belief system, for our philosophical, you know, I guess,
like the framework, I guess.
Yeah, the framework. Yeah, that's very, very important.
And I recognize that the Bible is just one of those books like any other, and there's a lot of good that can be taken away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't necessarily influence how I think about things in a current way. I mean, I'm very, very pro gay rights. I'm very, very pro choice.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, you know,
you're about human liberty,
right?
That's what I always say. I just believe in human liberty. I believe in individual liberty. I believe in allowing people to make their own choices. That includes whether they want to do drugs or not.
I agree.
That
with
includes
that too.
Whether they want to pay for sex or not. That includes whether they want to worship Satan or fucking, you know, Jesus Christ. It's up to you, man. I'm not going to let the state get involved in the marriage business. I don't understand that.
And much like going to see romantic comedies, I realized that every time I went into, even though I didn't want to sometimes, every time I'd go to church on a Sunday, and it's not every Sunday, I'm not going to sit here and say it is, but every time I do, I come away feeling a little bit more at ease and a little bit better about life.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the take-home message and the take-home product of it, even if there's nothing grander than that, so be it. And it's a place.
Karen Armstrong wrote an amazing book called The Case for God. She used to be an atheist. And she talks about religion. Religion runs into trouble when it starts dealing with truth with a capital T, when you start getting into fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is mostly in the notion that there's an obsession with purity and an obsession with the literal interpretation of whether it's the Quran or the Bible. There are some people that believe that everything in the Bible is written by God and it's literally true.
Yeah.
Instead of taking the symbolism from it, and the, you know, and I think those people are dumb-dums. I don't even think they're crazy.
They're just too impressionable to be adults.
Yeah. But, and that's where religion, but she always talks about religion, in fact, is has as much to do with things like when you hear a beautiful song. It's inspiring. It can make you feel profoundly sad and joyful at the same time. So there is a mystery to beautiful music.
Right.
Exactly like there is a mystery to communing with your own soul. And whether that's done through prayer or meditation or through listening to a priest read verses in Latin or in English or in French or whatever it might be, that is the value of religion. That
yeah.
It not only does it provide inspiration to be a better person, but it also provides the notion that there's something much bigger out there than you are.
That's huge.
And it inspires humility, you to help other people.
The humility to admit that, and to getting back to stuff we talked about earlier, especially for people in the entertainment industry, you do, everyone, I mean, I'm sure you're a victim of it just like I am, where you start to buy into your own BS, where if you have, if Loveline and Kevin Bean are getting a lot of listeners, you're getting a lot of fan mail, or you go out on the street and people want to take a picture. After Dancing with the Stars, people would want to take pictures with me. It blew my fucking mind.
Yeah.
And you start to get into a frame of mind that is totally wrong, and it's rancid. And if you, whether it's Jesus or Allah or whoever it may be, reminding yourself that you're not that big a deal and that there's much more powerful forces out there, it's good to be.
You're talking about idolatry, actually. I mean, one of the things, one of the sins in the Bible is talking about idolatry, right? They talk about, you know, the golden calf and why who was it, the Canaanites or something, they were worshiping Moses got really mad at him for worshiping the golden calf. This idea was that's kind of what the worship of celebrity is. It's worshiping false gods. False gods can be a golden calf. It can be money. It can be a beautiful car. It can be your own reputation. It can be your status. It can be your celebrity. And that's never actually a formula for success. I'll just tell you from my own personal opinion, you know, I'll get up on stage now. I've been doing stand-up a long time, and I was at the Laugh Factory on a Saturday night, which is one of my favorite place to perform in L.A. And, you know, it's packed, and you get off stage, and they're just whooping and clapping and hollering, and it's beautiful. I love making people laugh, but I can tell you that when you've done it long enough and you come to expect that kind of adulation, then, of course, people want to take pictures with you afterwards. There is no question that you become immune to that.
Yeah.
You just do. And if you don't have another reason for why you're doing it, well, then I guess you'll do the same set over and over again. But man, oh man, I could never do that. I mean, that will never sustain you. It'll never sustain
you.
That's kind of the problem with our culture, this sort of this celebrity worship. We actually worship people that are good at pretending. And we never really worship authors. I mean, when Herman Melville, who wrote Moby Dick, Billy Budd, etc., when he got married, the church was so full, people waiting out in the street to get a glimpse.
Yeah.
When Victor Hugo died, all of France went in the mourning, and a lot of people couldn't even read. Mainly that's because we didn't have fucking internet and TV and movies, and, you know, it didn't, you know, so a lot of our heroes are people we're actually seeing on screen, so you have to be fair to the context in which we're living, but there's no question that I think we worship false gods in this culture.
Yeah, and yeah. You do get immune to it, but then at some point it comes back around, and you remind yourself that what you do does have power, it does have meaning.
Yeah,
you know, because I also got to a point where I was like, fuck it, I'm gonna enlist because I can't devote my life to making Paris Hilton jokes on a morning radio show.
You want to go to the army?
And I was like, I'm gonna do something that means something. That's but then great. You realize that no, it does have value.
Well, you
it does
you provide have value.
Being a being a stand-up comic, being anything,
absolutely
giving people the ability to kind of you said, like, laugh or create their own thoughts with thoughts of your own, that there is value to that.
I take so much pride in the fact that I'm able to make people laugh. It feels like such a gift. I mean I went to Afghanistan. I was around a bunch of badasses, but to make those guys laugh,
right,
those men and women who'd been there for 15 months, to make them laugh and just give them a fucking second of just respite, that's such a privilege. That's very needed. Art in a culture, you know, is so important.
It's what separates humans. It is the only thing that separates humans from other species. We're the only people who make things specifically to be admired.
That's right. And because they're beautiful.
A beaver will build a dam. You know, bears build traps for other things. Other species build stuff. We create art specifically for no other function, just to look at it and appreciate it.
It's so fucking true, man. That's so true. Where you can't even understand it. All you know is it's beautiful.
Right.
You know, that you look at the Sistine Chapel or something, and it's like, that was one man's vision. I mean, Michelangelo went blind.
It's what happens when I look at your shoulders.
Thank you. God, I hear that all the time. Yeah. That's so. Are you suggesting my shoulders are very much like the Sistine Chapel?
I would say that your shoulders are the Sistine Chapel of shoulders.
I thought that for 45 years I was straight, but I have to say that this podcast has really changed my mind.
Yeah.
I hope you
will. I've known for 33 years that I'm barely straight.
That's fantastic.
And I think you're the camel that's going to break my heterosexual back.
I just pushed you over the edge.
Yeah.
God, I wish we had a swell of music right now. Maybe we'll cut that in.
You're a swarthy guy. I bet you've got, if you did not tend to it, you would have hairy, hairy balls and cock.
Well, I manscape. I'm not that hairy. My dad's a hairy son of a bitch, yeah. But I've got, you know, I'm not that hairy. I'm kind of like, I suppose if you were to shave a cheetah, I suppose that's kind of, I mean, I don't like to use metaphors, but.
I'm like prepubescent when it comes to body hair.
You got very smooth skin. You got brown skin. You're muscular.
If I was,
you don't have to wear a shirt.
10 years younger and didn't hit the crack and meth pipe as hard as I did, I'd be like a twink like dream come true.
You'd be a
in
Twinkie.
West Hollywood.
You'd
be I'd be a Twinkie, like, dude. I'd be like the poster boy for Twinkism.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're the kind of guy.
I'm hairless outside of like some frosting on my balls.
If I had to choose a cellmate, you'd be the guy.
Sweet.
Now, what's your workout consist of?
I like to, I train in jiu-jitsu, Gracie Baja Pasadena, and occasionally at Verdum's gym out where I live in Venice. And then, but, you know, mostly a lot of a variety. I like to lift heavy weights, and I like to do yoga and stuff for movement and range of motion. And I like to get it on, go and tie up my gi and go after it. I like to do things that really, I was in a bad place when I first got clean, where I was into bodybuilding, and nothing to knock the sport of bodybuilding. Yeah. But it was all about
requires
vanity.
Some. Yeah, it requires some endocrine tampering.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And yeah. I was fully onto. I translated from cocaine and whiskey to Deca and Winstrol.
How much did you weigh?
205. When I was like on stage,
that
I'd be, like,
shit works.
205 ripped, but I was like 225 walking around. 230.
Jesus, what and do you weigh right now?
172. 173.
So funny, man. Yeah. You can put on some crazy muscle with that shit. Huh? I've never done it. Someday. I'm just looking for one excuse.
Well,
my back hurts. Gotta get on it.
Nowadays, just to be honest, a very valid reason is you're 60.
Yeah, yeah, it's
and
true.
You don't do it like, you know, a pro
hormone replacement therapy.
Yeah, and you know, even, you know, very, very valid scientific minds believe in it. And I'm starting to, from just what I hear from Dr. Drew talk about at night, I'm starting to buy into it for women more so than men.
Really?
Oh, you talk to anyone who's given, any woman who's given hormone replacement post-menopause, they're like, I now understand what guys are going through that now.
Because they're taking testosterone.
I want to have sex, exactly.
Wow.
And they're bouncing out the estrogen to testosterone.
Fuck.
They want to have sex. They feel good about themselves. They're high on life. They don't go through that menopausal, you know, kind of that dysthymia and that bullshit that a lot of women go through.
Dude, I gotta get on. I gotta get involved.
Yeah, yeah, it's big time. But doing it to be 4% body fat at 205 is not a good reason.
Yeah, it's probably not. The problem with bodybuilding is it's just good for posing
right
in a mirror and marveling at yourself.
And everything I did for physically did not translate over to me emotionally and psychologically at all. And
no.
Now everything I do in the gym definitely does. It's more so about training my mind and the body. Training my body becomes a great byproduct of it. But I go in there to really try to push myself to do different things and develop myself.
I think you're a very smart guy. I think you should start maybe doing some stand-up. There, I said it on my podcast.
I want to.
I never tell people to do stand-up.
Just in the last two or three, I studied at Groundlings. I've been into like the idea of developing a comedic mind. But
you have one.
But the idea of stand-up has always been something I'd wanted. It was a shoulda, woulda, coulda. Just in the last 2 months, I've really been
just
analyzing.
Just tell stories. Make them funny.
Yeah. But getting out there and getting on stage, you know, it's a whole different thing. I mean,
but you know, you just keep doing it. It's like anything else. You just show up and fucking do it.
Yeah.
On that note,
all right,
Mike. I'm not calling you Psycho Mike because there's no story behind the psycho. It just sounded good, right?
Yeah. It's that is the story.
I love
a
that.
Program director at K-Rock and Kevin and Bean collectively agreed it sounds good coming out.
You're the farthest thing from a psycho.
You're such a
well-spoken, thoughtful dude.
Thank you. But to me, it's more like the name. Makes people think because you know in radio you get the voice, you don't get the image. People meet me and they're like, what the fuck? Like, they're expecting some guy with tattoos on
his
head and
where's the bat tattoo to your face and the track marks? What the fuck? Psycho Mike Atherwood, ladies and gentlemen, from K-Rock and Loveline's Dr. Drew.
Mr. Callan, I gotta get you on Loveline now.
Anytime.
I'm making a personal vow to
anytime. I'd be so happy to do it. And thanks for joining the Man Thoughts podcast.
It's been my pleasure.
This is such an easy. What an easy motherfucker to talk to. What a fucking... refreshing. No wonder. You should get into radio. I'm hilarious! Once again, I'll be at the Fort Lauderdale Improv. By the time this airs, I might have already been there. We'll figure it out.
Just do this month. Do next month, too. Do you know those two?
What are next months?
Fort Lauderdale.
Watch this. Hold. I might be shooting my pilot next, so I don't know if I can say that. So let's not worry about it.
I'm racing on my iPhone. I gotta go through spankwire.com, RedTube. Shit.
Oh darn! It takes so much. I'll be at the Helium in Philly, November 8th, 9th, 10th. So and then I'll be at the Gotham Comedy Club, November 15th, 16th, and 17th in New York City. I hope to see you guys out there. This is Man Thoughts with Ryan Cal. Bye bye.
You've been listening to Man Thoughts with Brian Callen.